You're listening to the UCB Long Form Conversations podcast, in-depth conversations with performers and teachers from the best alternative comedy theater on the planet. This podcast is modeled on the improv form La Ronde, so the guest of our last episode becomes the host of this episode, and today's guest will become the host of our next episode. The opinions expressed in this episode are those of the comedians talking and don't necessarily reflect the opinions of UCB Theater or Training Center.
Warning. What you're about to hear is an extremely nerdy conversation about long-form improv comedy.
Welcome to the UCB Long-Form Conversations podcast from Los Angeles. I am Paul Scheer. I was a guest on the last episode, but today I am the host. And my guest today, you know this guy, from shows like The League, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, TV's I'm Sorry.
Oh, yeah.
Scene stealing parts in movies like The Dictator, The House.
I'm not enjoying this.
Hip podcast maker, Comedy Bang Bang, How Did This Get Made? The one, the only, Jason Mantzoukas. Please welcome yourself to
welcome
this podcast.
Myself. Oh, that was, by the way, flawless introduction.
It was pretty great.
Flawless.
I just did this.
How'd it go?
It went great.
Yeah.
Because
who interviewed you?
Cale Hills.
Okay.
And you know, I think you and I both can agree that you don't get often asked about improv, right?
Sure.
Everyone wants to talk about a million other things and
totally.
Stuff like that. So it is fun to kind of nerd out about.
It's one of my favorite topics.
Mine too. And you know, you and I had interesting trajectories because I think we were involved at UCB at roughly the same time?
Ish. You were there before me by at least a year, maybe?
Yeah, when did you get involved?
Like 98.
What brought you to UCB?
I saw, I came to visit New York when UCB was doing Saigon Suicide Squad upstairs at KGB.
Oh, wow.
In the Red Room.
Yeah.
And so I was visiting New York. My friend Rodney Rothman, who you know as well, who I had done improv with in college,
right,
was at that point living and was a writer at Letterman, and had heard about UCB. I think they were just doing maybe they'd been doing the Luna Lounge spots,
the Rebar
like
stuff,
Rebar,
right.
and then we're doing Saigon Suicide Squad at KGB, and so we went to see it. But somebody was missing, and so they instead did just an ASCAT night.
Oh wow!
And the guests were Dranch, Stephen Colbert, the regular UCB, and then I think maybe McCann or one of the Conan, or maybe Stack. I don't remember exactly who, but because I didn't know them at the time. And it was mind-blowing. And at the end, as they used to do, and I'm sure still do to some degree or another, they announced that they were teaching classes.
Yeah.
And so I was like, oh, yeah, no, that's what I'm going to do.
And so
I went home.
Were you doing improv before this, or you were like, I'm just going to take an improv? Was it like?
No, I had done improv in college. We had like a group in college that was, when I got to school, I started school in February. Mm-hmm. And they had started an improv group that fall.
Okay.
So it was very new. And so I got in the next fall.
And what were they doing? Like, what was their
short
like,
form.
Okay.
It was just
right.
short form games.
That was the same way I came up,
totally.
Too. Like, yeah. It was
totally.
Like
you know, and it, this is also coincides with when they are doing, or they are showing British Whose Line Is It Anyway on
Comedy Central?
Something.
Yes, yeah.
I
remember
so
seeing
I
that.
Had also seen it in that capacity right. as well. And so I was like, oh, I want to do that. I want to do that. And so we got into, I got into that group, started doing short form. And then I think maybe right before our junior year, same person, Rodney Rothman, did an internship in New York.
Right.
And took classes or did something at Chicago City Limits.
I do remember him being around there for like Chicago City Limits was interesting because it was the only, like, game in town. There was Burn Manhattan, but that was, like, inconsequential, ultimately.
Yeah. Yeah,
and,
screw you guys.
Come on, Todd Stashwood, bring it. No, they were very good performers. It was just sort of like...
Oh, yeah, no, it wasn't the same institutionalized kind of environment.
Yes,
absolutely.
And
but they were great.
They were, really fantastic. I remember paying them a lot of money to coach us.
Like, oh,
they
did you really?
Oh, yeah. They were
that's
like,
funny.
Did you ever have to pay a lot of money for, like, like high level
coaches? As prestige-y coaches as we got were really just somebody just moved here from Chicago. Well, and we would get them.
Okay, so like we had Ali Farinakian as a coach, and he was like charging us like $175 for like an hour and a half coaching session. We did like Krav Maga for like most of it.
I did his class when he came, he taught a class. It was like a big to-do. I took that class, and like I think day one, we all had to act like animals stalking around the room silently while he read aloud passages to us from The Legend of Bagger Vance.
Oh my God.
Can you imagine me like doing that class? Oh, I was like, no, this is not good.
That is one of the worst things to do. Like that's why you're not taking an acting class. Mm-hmm. You're taking an improv class. Were you in the class that painted the fire hydrants?
No. Okay. That was the next class after. That was this class he taught after my class was cleaning up trash and painting fire hydrants. Yeah.
So that was like always an interesting thing, but.
Nonsense.
So you signed up for UCB, and
so
who was
first? So then I moved to New York. Rodney, after his Chicago City Limits thing, brought back the book Truth in Comedy.
Okay.
So we all read the book Truth in Comedy, and we started a long form group. So we started we did our short form shows in like the big student center to like, you know, 400 people or whatever.
Yeah.
But then we started doing a long form show, like Harold's, what we perceived to be a Harold.
Of course, yeah.
We started doing in the coffee shop at school. And
that was like your independent theater.
It was our kind of cool, like, we're going to do this other thing.
Yeah.
But we'd never seen a Harold, nor did we really fundamentally understand it. We just had the description in the book. So our Harold's lasted an hour. Our pattern games were true word association, like breakfast, cereal, pancakes. And they would go on for like 10-15 minutes. It was awful. It was truly like terrible stuff, but it was so exciting.
Well, because like I remember the first time I saw long form, I didn't even know that existed.
Yeah.
Right? You know, so seeing UCB do long form, because they would do, like, I remember the first UCB show I saw was Punch Your Friend in the Face.
Okay.
And same thing, someone was missing, and McKay filled in for whoever was missing. I think Walsh was missing.
Yeah.
And you know, I didn't know McKay from anything, you know, and then they did this like half hour improv set at the end, and it was like, whoa, wait, what is this? Like, like your mind was just, from going from short form to seeing that,
course.
There was no thing. So you at least had like an idea of what it was, and then you saw like a professional
it was like I came at it from outside in.
Right.
Like I first almost academically learned it like from a book, then saw it done and was like, oh, wait a minute. And then so came to New York, saw them do an ASCAT, then I moved to New York. And when I moved to New York, they were already at Solo Arts.
Right.
They were out of those other spaces and were set up at Solo Arts. So my first shows were the ASCAT Sunday night Solo Arts shows. And then classes were at Solo Arts.
And those shows were pretty amazing because it's sort of like I remember like walking those five floors up there to get
waiting
up
in line up the stairs.
Oh, you'd have to get online on a Sunday early.
Oh yeah,
and
Ed Snibel would flyer the line in his jester's hat, advertising for Mortal Kombat.
Oh man!
So like when I start, those shows are already going.
Okay, so
Mortal Kombat.
So you're just like a little bit ahead of me because I started. Yeah. Right when I started right when they first started teaching classes. Mm-hmm. Like I was in that first round of classes.
Right.
And it was cheap. And I remember, were you up there? Were you there when the UCB, the first UCB meeting, like town hall meeting?
I think
on the
so.
Roof?
Oh, no.
It was great because, you know, it was small and it got bigger. And then everyone was in class and was like, all right, we need to have like a theater meeting. And we all went up to the roof of Solo Arts, which was already a rickety fucking building.
Oh, that building was not cool.
It was like you felt like the stairs were going to fall out from underneath you as you walked up them. And the elevator could take like three people at a time, and that was it. We were on the roof, and like the UCB were like, we have to like start charging more for classes.
Oh, funny.
But there was this energy. It was like, I think I remember like Amy Poehler was like, we're charging more for classes. And you know why? Because we're worth it. And I was like, yeah, they are. Like, you know, like, there was this energy like around them. And it wasn't like they were bullshitting. It was like, you know, a lot of other people would be like, we got to charge more. And, you know, but they were very punk rock.
They very much understood their value and the value of what they were doing in a scene that, that they were literally building.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, just to kind of fast forward, because I know we have, like, limited time, so I want to, like, just talk about some improv stuff in general, too. So you get involved there and...
Yeah, I take those classes. My teachers are Armando and then the UCB4.
Oh, wow, so Armando is teaching me new there. Yeah. Oh, because Armando, for me, was the, oh, we got the new guy in from Chicago, sure. And it was so exciting,
yes. He was, and because Armando is the person also who put Mother together, which was, like, the Herald team that I was on for 8-9 years.
Well, that's, like, your, I mean, because is Mother essentially, like, what Soundtrack is now, or some version, or, like, some...
For sure, yeah.
And that's the same thing with Respecto. Respecto was this thing, and now we are whatever we are, but we're assemblage
and while
of that.
Soundtrack isn't, because Soundtrack is also, like... There is certainly, like, a bunch of people who were on Mother, but then a ton of people who weren't on Mother make up the L.A. Soundtrack show. But Mother itself was a group that came up with that form, with the, we're going to play songs from, the suggestion is songs from the audience, and we'll do improv scenes that use those songs as the soundtrack. That we did for, you know, and 6 years in New York on Saturday nights, probably.
It was awesome to see that show. And I will make a bigger statement here and say, like, I feel like... like when we all came out, like everyone was doing like shows, I felt like there were like, I'm maybe going to put my, I may elevate myself here, but I don't mean to. Like, I think it was like the Swarm and some version of like Respecto or Cowbot was like the doing shows first. And
then
I always felt like that Mother, there was like almost like two sides. It was like Ruru was kind of like more in the Respecto side, and then Mother was more on the Swarm side. Like, is there?
Yeah.
Like,
cause I think that's true.
You guys did like, and I always like was amazing to watch. It was like this very well acted, kind of slow, deliberate.
Yeah, we were definitely
very
slower.
Funny and,
we were definitely slower in almost in response. I feel like because at the time. At the time, because Respecto didn't exist yet, because it was still Cowbot and Frank Johnson, essentially, were the were the two teams that you guys were. So, and Ruru's, like, is whatever, I think two cycles after Mother.
Okay.
And so at the time, like, we were really, like, we trying to, like, it was a time when there were few teams, but everything seemed, you remember this.
No, of course.
Everything seemed so important.
It was the biggest thing.
So important.
And rehearsing
and
showing
really,
up. And
it was really, for us, like, important, like, on an identity level, that we, because we were like, we're not going to do what these other guys are doing. Like,
right.
We're not, structurally, our ensemble was different. And for us, I feel like we settled into much more narrative-based shows. Like, our shows were heavy narrative.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of our scenes were connected. A lot of times, our scenes would start connecting, but well before third beats, and the whole thing would collapse into one big story.
Yeah.
And, like, we, in our first form, this was a form called The Sleepover, and it was just, like, a choose-your-own-adventure kind of big play that we would improvise.
I don't know if I remember seeing that.
We didn't do it for too long. It was exhausting to do. It was very hard.
Well, because talk to me about that form, just because I've known.
Way it would work is we'd get a suggestion. People would step forward on stage with a character, like, declaration.
Okay.
So.
I am this. Or,
it's something like that. Or it can be a bit of dialogue, too. Like, if you cross me again, I'll kill you. You
got
know
it.
What I mean?
Okay,
like, whatever. Just, like, something.
Yeah.
And you keep repeating that phrase until everybody comes on stage. Music is playing.
Yeah.
It's very kind of atmospheric. And then the last person to step out approaches one of the other people and starts a scene.
Oh, nice.
That scene starts. And at a point, whenever, everybody starts to, again, step out onto stage and starts repeating their wants again.
Oh,
and
wow.
The person who didn't choose now chooses a second person to go forward within that scene.
Oh, I love that
And
form.
So you're always choosing, you're always... you are always passively chosen.
Right.
You are not actively choosing. So the person who's come before you chooses.
And so they're basically making their initiation based off your thing.
Based off what you're doing or what your emotional thing seems like or whatever. But what we were improvising was a single narrative. So everybody's, once you start choosing, you're always that same character. You never change characters. And everything essentially... It a little bit is what became Armando then. Armando directed the show. I think Armando, after this, created the Evente.
Well, that was, yeah, because we were the first people who did Evente. And I was going to say...
It was I feel like in doing our show, Armando was like, ooh, there's a simpler, better way to do this in a very good way.
Well,
and he was right.
What you were describing, I was like, oh, that feels like Evente to me. And then that made me think to myself, I'm like, you know, it's interesting because... I was able to take classes with the UCB 4, and at a certain point, the UCB 4 were expanding. Like, you know, it was sort of like, you know, they were doing their show at Comedy Central, and there was things. And I really feel like Armando doesn't get as much credit as he maybe do, or as he should, because
I think
he really artistically curated these voices. Like, now, obviously, like, you know, we did Evente, and we did an Evente Respecto. It was a group of... loud,
sure,
like bombastic, kind of like, ah, you know, and I feel like, and you guys I always looked at as being like, I always liked watching you guys because I felt like you guys kind of towed a line of like, you could do some bigger stuff that had like a lot of energy, and then you could do some quieter stuff that was like very character based. And the Swarm I felt were always doing almost methodical.
Yes.
It was like, it was interesting to see a line of all the teams because every team kind of was doing a variation of a theme.
Yes.
Off of what the UCB kind of...
A little bit. And also at a certain point, I think people started to choose teams as their reference points.
Right.
Or, you know, like I saw it later in classes when I was a teacher where students would choose teachers.
Yes.
You know, like I remember at a certain point I was teaching, like the advanced classes were being taught by me, Billy, and Delaney in New York. And you could tell, like, students were like, oh, I'm a Billy guy, or I'm a Delaney guy, or I'm a Mandzukas guy. And I remember having a conversation with those three guys about being like, oh, we have to make sure that people understand, like, we're teaching the same thing.
But
like,
you know,
it's not about, like, you might, whatever, but it's not, we're not the same.
But don't you think...
I mean, we are the same.
But don't you think, and I feel like when I was teaching classes at UCB, it was a little bit like the Wild West. We talked about the painting fire hydrants and stuff like that. You were basically teaching. It was like apprenticeship teaching. It was like, I learned this, and now I have I know what I need to teach here.
Sure.
But there was no syllabus.
Oh, no.
There was no
curriculum. Yeah. There was nothing.
And so you are basically dictating what you want. Like, we're all working towards the same goal.
Sure.
Like, but it was interesting because I think back in the day, every teacher was a little bit different. And I think
categorically so.
And that's how when I took the classes with the UCB 4, it was like Besser was premise based.
Yes.
Walsh was organic. Amy was kind of a mix between the two. And Ian was kind of probably more on the Besser side of being very
mathematical.
And it was interesting because you actually were all learning the same thing.
Totally.
None of them are going to contradict, but it was how you get there. And I think that is
I understood that, and I understand that, you know, like, because I took all those classes as well with all those people. And you did. You had moments with each teacher where you were like, oh, like I found Amy to be like so cogent in explaining stuff the way that I could hear it.
Yes, me too.
But then in Ian's class, Ian would improvise with you.
Oh, Ian would do a whole scene.
That was so helpful just in practice to be like, ooh, I'm improvising with Ian Roberts. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, what? And then also if it wasn't me that he did a scene with, watching him improvise with someone else.
Oh.
Like, that was hugely important.
It
you
was
know?
Funny because, you know, I never have seen anyone else do it as well, but Ian could get up with the worst person in your class.
Sure.
And do a great scene.
Oh, yeah.
And it was amazing to watch. And I would say, like, when I've performed with Ian in the past, you have to be almost aware that he doesn't need any, like, he's like a ball that's just rolling. So he's just getting fat. So unless you kind of jump in front of
him. You've ever seen him do Lazy Man, you know he doesn't need you.
No, yeah.
You know?
He just, so you have to, like, actively, like, pop in.
And, and you have to, like, really, Ian is someone who will fill in everything. So you have to carve out your space.
You almost, like, I always felt like with Ian, it's like you have to throw the first punch. Like, you know, like a metaphorical punch.
Sure.
Like, because it was like, I need to, like, get some control here because this is a, you know, or I'm just going to be standing here stirring up an imaginary pot, you know, like, you know,
it's funny.
But now I want to, like, also talk about the idea of, like, the way that you approach improv, because I think I think, you know, watching you, Billy, and Delaney, you are three different performers.
Oh, yeah. Very
entirely different. And
in the same way that it's a, not to interrupt you, sorry, but like in that same way that you are describing how the personalities of all the teams are different, you can reduce it to the personalities of individual performers. And there is like very stark differences, you know?
Well, and it's, I think, a good mix is interesting for a team, right? It's always like,
well, that's why, to get to your Armando point. How important Armando was in, I feel like, Armando came around right at that time when UCB, I feel like, was having, like, a real growth spurt.
Yes.
You know, basically, he came in right before 22nd Street happened, and he took over as artistic director and also, like, basically head of the school.
Yeah.
And I would argue that at that, previous to that, it is Wild West. It is really, like, you've got teams that are kind of cobbled together from either pre-existing outside teams, like the Swarm is primarily all the boys from Florida.
Right.
You know?
And also these, like, half-assed Herald team. Yeah. There was no committee at that point.
Right.
So it was sort of like, all right, these two people aren't really fitting in, so we'll take them off that team. And then we took two people off that team. Then we're merging these two teams. And it was almost like, go and figure it out. Like, I remember Besser, I was talking about this on my episode, was basically like, go, break up your team. Because and go find your own team. That's what you're supposed to do.
Yeah.
But that's how it was kind of being handled. And the only person that was really creatively pushing forward the theater, in my opinion, was Besser. Besser was like, I'm going to relaunch Feature. I'm going to relaunch Real Real World. I'm going to relaunch. He was like, I'm creating shows and launching shows.
Totally.
And, you know, and
Don't
Walsh
forget
was
Cartoon Chaos,
Cartoon
please.
Chaos, please. Cartoon Chaos. the spinoff of the Real Real World, which is like the, like, we
It came right after. It wasn't, maybe it was a spinoff. I don't know.
Because they had the same thing as the director.
It came right after Feature. He did the Feature class.
Yeah.
And then he did this class.
Right.
That created Cartoon Chaos.
Who's
which
Holden?
Was,
Oh,
some of these are bad shows.
Yeah.
We did Cartoon Chaos for over a year, midnights on Saturday night. And I
Ricky Martin. Jason played Ricky Martin.
I played Ricky Martin. I'm going to say we had maybe, at best, three good shows. And that is, like, at best.
I remember
the
that.
The show never worked.
I remember, like, not to name names, but I remember the director of that show, not the actual, like, stage director, but, like, the on-set calling director, Best, like, you got to go in there. You show them what you do in real world. But it was like such a fuck you. And like I said, all these drama moments that are like, because it was like, now I'm going in and literally
have to explain something. Yeah.
It's going like, you sit down in this show. I'm going to do this thing that I don't want to do because I don't have any. And there was like a lot of that shit that would pit people against each other unintentionally and stuff like that.
There was also a time when there were so few people that you could have rivalries and animosities.
Yeah. We had a rivalry with Neutrino. I mean, we had this big thing.
And your guys' rivalry was predicated on
Besser.
Our cage match.
You're right. Yeah.
This was like a real feud that developed. So it was. I'm going to finish my one thought,
and then I
want to talk about this. What I was going to say is, I think Armando was the true benefit of Armando Diaz in the scene was that he really built that next generation of teams as very strong ensembles.
And,
you know, from Mother to Ruru to even like, you know, I'm going to say even like the Bureau or like some of those other teams that didn't last as long, but were still pretty good teams.
Well, yeah, but Armando had this thing that I thought was really smart, which was, I'm not giving short shrift to UCB for, but I just think what he was able to do was talk the language of whatever team he was putting together.
Yeah.
Like, and I feel like it was the reason why he would be able to direct Mother and make you guys excel, and he could do Respecto and make us excel. Like he just knew how to be like, that's your thing, and I'm going to cater to that. Like, where other teachers, I think, will pull you into their style.
Point of view.
Yes.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Like, he never encouraged us to be like Respecto.
Yes.
Or like a Ruru.
No,
or
he
like
let
a Swarm.
The team
you know?
Be the voice that it was.
Truly.
So
it's Mother versus Respecto. And this is like, Cage Match was pretty new, I think.
And
at this point,
were
nothing
high.
Higher.
Was like, it was really a point of pride. Like, we won. We were the funniest. We were deserved to be
there. I'm going to guess this is like 2001?
It had to be,
something like that.
Yeah.
Kevin Mullaney had just come to town and introduced the show he'd started it in Chicago and introduced it to New York. And New York was like so ready for competition, I feel like.
It was a point of pride.
Oh, yeah. Because, and this is, again, at a time when Nobody had agents. Nobody was on TV.
No.
Nobody was known. The best you could do, the only thing we were all striving for, I feel like, was 9:30 on Herald Night.
Oh, and
was the anchor night, the anchor slot on Herald Night.
And I think being accepted in that, like,
sure.
You know, like being like, I mean, it was like a big, oh, Besser's watching, or somebody's watching,
oh, yeah.
Like, you got to do a good job, you know, like
totally.
That pressure. Yeah.
And so the introduction of competition was like a bomb went off in the scene. And at the time, I think the better teams were obviously The Swarm, which was always like the best.
Yeah.
And then you guys and then us. You know?
That's what I remember it being like that three.
And Neutrino, Neutrino was famous. We're building a following for stunts.
Right.
You know, like because you can win cage match one of two ways. Have the better show and get the votes, or stack the audience / do a stunt / cheat, essentially.
Well, yeah, like the idea was, and the idea ultimately was to get people to come to these shows.
Yep.
You would fire your friends so your friends would vote for
yes,
you.
Yes, you'd say, fill the audience with our people and just vote for us no matter what.
Exactly. Whereas I think now, especially in LA, it feels
that's
much
hard.
More people are coming to LA to be like, I want to see the show, I'm going to vote on who I like.
And by the way, there was nothing better than a show that you knew they stacked the audience for,
oh,
but
yeah.
Your team still won.
Oh, I know.
That
yeah.
was like a great, Oof. That was like a sweet
because their friends
victory.
Betrayed
yes.
them and they like yeah. they knew that you were, yeah.
But everybody was allowed a timeout was the
yes.
gimmick. And you could do whatever you wanted in the timeout. People would pass out beer. People would
yeah, to
like,
sway the audience.
All sorts of like trying to suck up to the audience or do something scandalous or whatever. Neutrino was like the kings of this.
Yeah.
Mother hated it. Mother oh. hated the stunts.
We
this is like
never had a good
not
interested. Stunt.
We didn't even do them for a while.
We did a thing called Dildo Circus, and like yeah. we were like the most half-assed thing. Because there was always like tons of dildos backstage, and we're like, we'll just throw the like. We didn't yeah. know like there was a pressure of this
so
timeout,
yeah.
and it was like, yeah.
And so we had the idea. We were like, why don't we just have Neutrino do our timeout?
Yeah.
You know, like let's have them just the stunt will be. So we that's what we did. What we didn't know was that Neutrino also stacked the audience to have a write-in vote for Neutrino.
Right.
And so when the
so it wasn't
show
like,
ended.
Yeah, it wasn't like that Mother was going to win.
We had no idea. We thought it was just a funny thing that they
yeah.
were going to do. But they were double-crossing us and being like, oh, no. Which I still think is really funny
in retrospect,
and great. I can't
amazing.
Believe we didn't even anticipate this because,
yes.
Of course. So they won the show. They won the show and were sitting right in the front row when Mulaney said Neutrino won.
And you and I think, you know, talking about this competition, it was interesting because it's like, I think it was a point of pride there. It was like us against you guys. And it was like,
oh, yeah.
you know, and it's
we
like,
were like the big teams of that generation.
Right. And it was sort of like this. There it had more stakes than if another, you know, you wanted
oh, yeah.
to do a good job. And I think what I remember, I could be wrong. I felt like we had a good show. Like, and we never
oh, yeah.
had good shows. We never
That's
had
funny.
Good. Like, I was saying this before. We never had, whenever the push came to shove, I feel like Respecta would eat shit. And I remember
That's
that one
funny.
Being good. And when it was Neutrino
oh,
winning.
Yeah.
Like, for me, I was like, fuck them.
Oh,
I got
yeah, yeah.
angry.
Oh, no,
like,
you guys got mad.
Yeah.
I remember you guys got mad. And I didn't get mad. I just was like, I liked the
yeah.
gamesmanship of it. But you guys, that was, and I remember that being, I feel like, and I might be misremembering, I feel like that was the beginning of the animosity between those two teams.
Well, because Besser stoked it immediately.
Yeah.
Like, Besser came on stage, was like, you yell at them, and then they're
yeah.
like, let's have a rematch.
And then the next week, the three of us did a three-way show.
Yeah, that was like a fucking crazy time. And again, looking back at it, it's like, oh, it's a stupid
so silly.
Fucking.
But it meant everything.
Oh.
It meant everything. Yeah. At the cage match was so, because
There weren't even that many teams.
I feel like now, like even a couple of years ago, like I was on me, Zach Woods, Lennon, and St. Clair went on a run at cage match.
Right.
You know, and this is maybe four years ago. Even still, we're like wildly senior players, like
yeah.
you know, coming into something in which we're you know, or whether it's Heather and Miles too. Like
right.
these are hugely senior people, but like I think what you have to understand. At the time, there were no senior players. There
right.
was nobody older than us.
Right. And
we
people,
were the we were the adult, not the adults, but we were the most senior, except for the Swarm, really.
And no one was putting together, no one was putting together their own teams for cage match at that point. It was Herald teams were competing.
Oh, yeah. It was only, it was, that was what it was supposed to be. It was like meant to be like, you guys have to compete with each other.
Right. So it wasn't like, it wasn't like, oh, we could all put together a fun cage match team. It was a different mentality.
No, it felt more like an outgrowth of like the actual Herald Knight.
Yes.
It felt like, oh, not just do you do Heralds, you also like, there is competition on this other night during late night.
It was a very like, I mean, it was an aggressive time. But let me talk to you about like your, like we all got ingrained when we were at the UCB, like when you're teaching a class or when you were teaching people, I want to talk about two different sides of this.
Yeah, sure.
What was something that you always like passed on? Like if you were to say, oh, if I looked at all my classes, I could probably narrow it down to like, these are the things that I always tried to instill in my, in my classes.
For me, it was point of view. Mm-hmm. I found that a lot of times people were having trouble with like, you know, finding the game as if it was this elusive pre-existing thing they just needed to find.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, and if I just keep digging around, it's going to be there.
Right, right.
And it almost had this kind of like magical quality or something about it that like did, and I feel like probably still does, really confound people as if it's like a trick.
Well, yeah.
And I was, and so my thing was always like, it isn't a trick. It really is just, how quick can you two find something, some shared pattern of behavior that will allow this, you know, basically, if I come in with a point of view on something, it's so much more of a gift than being like, here, I got you this beer.
Right.
You know, if I come in with like, you know, if I had a gun right now, I'd kill you for what you just did to me. You know, like, you now know a lot, you know, you're like, and that's, it's a lot easier to start from a place of emotional understanding, or to give the gift, you know, like when we talk about like giving a gift to your scene partner or whatever, I would always stress that the gifts that are really worth giving are emotional point of view gifts that are not just like, here we are at this restaurant. It looks good.
It's brain versus gut.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, for me, one of the things that was so hard to unlearn was that premise-based improv, because it was so ingrained in me for so long. And then part of that was getting on Respecto for me to be like, oh, we don't need to do this. And we can get, and I think all of us came up in that very structured thing. And I think the bombasticness of our playing was in response to that pressure of, I need to say this big, one thing, a big initiation that has everything in it. Your point of view, my point of view.
Totally.
The world.
Like that, and that really was early on how specifically I feel like Besser taught it, which was when you step out, your initiation better have like
who, what,
the
where,
game.
Yeah.
You better have like distilled from the opening.
Which is an impossible task.
It's a very difficult, it's a very difficult way to do it. It is a valid way to do it.
Yeah.
And I think there are plenty of other people who operate in a very similar way. It did not work for me. I could not, very quickly, I was like, I can't do this way.
What I think you just said about the point of view, it just distills everything, because it's sort of, to me, even in sketch writing, when I first started to do it, like, I feel like premise-based sketch writing even feels so like, okay, I know what this is going to be. And like, and what you did, and when I first saw you and Jessica St. Clair's sketch show, it was so kind of wonderful, because it was not of... It was had a more narrative bent to it. It wasn't of like, here's the funny specific, and we're going to heighten, and then be done with it.
No, not at all. It was like, you know, 13-minute breakup scenes.
Right,
and they really have a game, but are just, you know, like...
But they were hilariously funny and so captivating. But I think that was like the battle, and I don't know how that battle still plays out here, but that was the battle that was going on. Yeah.
I would also, the other thing that I would do a lot is just to kind of, again, demystify the idea of the game, is I would do classes where I would give, like, two people get on stage, and I would give them games. Like,
that's
I would be like, this is the game.
Right.
Right? And then the easiest one is, you know, you're here to break up with this person at dinner, and this person, you are here to propose to this person.
Great.
Okay.
It's fun because that was like, I did sing similar things like that, because it was like, It is. It's like once they felt like they had the keys, and they just, it was again, point of view. It
totally.
Just allow you to play. And
that's
then
all it is.
Not
and
in your
when
head.
People realize, oh, all I'm trying to discover is that.
Yeah.
That's it. And but what was interesting is then once that scene was done, two people sit down, two more people get up, same game.
Yes.
You're here to propose, you're here to break up. And watch that. It's because to me, improv scenes are like love songs or pop songs. They're all the same thing.
Right.
It's just the individual people performing it are different and bring their thing to it. So it's like, now give me your version of breakup proposal. Now give me your version of breakup proposal, you know?
Yeah.
And people start to be like, oh, wait, I get now. This is simpler than I thought. I'm not looking for this big thing at the top of a mountain I need to figure
right.
out. It's really just, I want, what do I want? And listening, because listening to me is paramount. Like, mm-hmm. the most important thing always was listening. You know, what do I want? How can I communicate it? And if I'm doing a good job listening to what this person wants, then there's a million ways to commit that.
It's funny because, you know, obviously we've been performing for a long time. And do you, I get this way every now and then when I'm on stage. Like, when you feel like you are trying to communicate to your partner, and these are people that I play with forever
sure.
and I have the most trust in, but you're like, oh, just, I can't.
Yeah.
I can't get in.
Yeah.
I'm like, and I'm trying. And it's like, it's funny because it's like there's, you know, even though we all know these things.
Sure.
Like, and I'm
or
like,
it happens too. I feel like especially if you sit in with people you don't normally play with
yeah.
or whatever you because I do, you know, shows every week.
Yeah.
But with people I've been doing shows with forever.
Yeah.
But then every once in a while I'll sit in on a show or something and you're playing with people who even if they are as seasoned.
Yeah.
It's just all of a sudden you get weirdly polite. Everybody gets this, and it's you can have really weird shows.
Yeah, it's bizarre because it like and you're overthinking things.
Sure.
And, so talk to me about now you perform Soundtrack, which you've been doing for a while,
yep.
but you also have this show that happens pops up a bunch where it's like Manzoukasand, right? And so talk to me about the impetus for creating that show and why. That show, like what was the, why did you go like, I want to do that in this specific way?
That show grew out of a couple of other shows that I was doing for a while. One of which I've been doing for like 10 years, which is in New York called the Manzoukas Brothers.
Right.
And it's me and Ed Herbstman, who is a Chicago improviser who lives in New York now and started the Magnet Theater with Armando. And we did a show for a long time that is just... It's a two-man show, and it is typically like a few very long scenes.
Right.
Followed by a very antagonistic question and answer period with the audience.
That's, I never knew that. That's hilarious.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know that that's how it ended.
Yeah. So, and sometimes the question and answer period would go on for like 30 minutes, 35
that's
minutes,
amazing.
And it is purposefully, I am angry. With the audience, and Ed is trying to placate, and it is a very—it's very.
Are they
fun.
Asking questions about the show?
About the show, yes.
That's great.
And so that we were doing that for years, and then I was doing this show called "Skinny Business Will Not Apologize." That is, that was the because it was me and St. Clair who did a show called "I Will Not Apologize," and Zach Woods and Lennon Parham who'd done a show under the name "Skinny Business."
Got it. Okay.
So this was the four of us all together, and we did this. We did Cage Match for a while, and we did other shows for a while, and it would frequently kind of. Just devolve into mono scenes, like
right.
one big long kind of scene, entrances and exits,
yeah.
blah, blah, blah. And it was really fun. And there was one week where we were doing Cage Match and nobody showed up, so I did it alone.
Okay.
So I did a 30-minute show,
yeah.
one scene, and I didn't
was
talk
it? Oh, wow.
at all. So it was like a single 30-minute silent scene.
What did you do?
It's really interesting. And the reason this is the catalyst for the show that I did, it was like very much the first time in, I don't know, 10 years that I felt like really challenged
on
stage. Really like, what am I going to do?
Yeah.
And I was up against Curtis Gwynn.
Oh, wow.
Because what I was going to do was I was going to just pull somebody out of the audience and do a show with them.
And I've done that. And that's
full
like
of improvisers.
So fun, yeah.
It's Cage Match. I was like, I'll get somebody good.
Yeah.
It'll be fun. I'd done that before as well, and I thought that would be good. And that is literally what his gimmick was.
Got it. Okay.
So I was like, oh, I can't do that. That's what he's here to do. So I was like, well, let's see. You know?
Yeah.
So I did a silent scene, and it's all patterns, and it's about a guy who's going between eating, making and cooking a meal, trying to write a letter. No, not trying to write a letter. Trying to make a phone call. He keeps trying to make a phone call, hanging up. Trying to make a phone call, hanging up. And it's just, he does all of this stuff, and it basically is the 30 minutes of this man's life that lead up to the final moment where I walk over, pull a gun out of a drawer, and kill myself. And yeah.
And when did you stumble on that in your mind? Do you go like, oh, I want to end there? Did you get that before?
Like midway through. Like once I started with the phone calls that I couldn't make, I was like, what is this? And I was like, ooh, I feel like there's a true dark ending here.
And what about, when did you decide not to talk?
Oh, like within the first minute.
Okay.
I didn't know until I started.
Got it.
But it seemed like obvious. Right. Because in my mind, I was like, okay, to talk, when you're alone on stage, you have very few options.
Yeah.
You can be a one-sided phone call. You can be narrating your own story,
right.
giving voice to your interior monologue.
Right.
I started by just like kind of. The other thing was the show required me to do a thing which I am almost loath to do constantly, which is object work.
Oh.
So I suddenly was like, okay, I have to like establish stuff.
Yeah.
And in doing so, I was like, oh, I don't have to talk. I can just exist in this space. It won't matter. You know, it didn't seem necessary exactly.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was so challenging that I was like, oh, I want to do a show where like, where we just do, so Manzoukas And is, you know, a monthly show I do here in LA, and it's one, me and a guest, and it's one scene for an hour. And then there is a question and answer period that is not antagonistic. That is, because it is improv students a lot who come, I do open it up in an effort to be like, this is a show that is structurally unlike most shows you would see as an improv student. Like, what do you got?
Well, the thing that I love about that, and it's, and what I've loved, like I've did a show with Jack McBrayer for a while called
Ghost
McBrayer.
Ship.
Oh yeah, Ghost Ship. Yeah, which is like we'd always the key to that show was we'd always mention Ghost Ship in some way, and
the movie Ghost Ship.
And
how have we never done that on the podcast?
Oh my gosh, I know we should. Yeah. And we'd always argue about what the premise of it was. Was it a ship of ghosts or was it a ghost ship? And so whatever. But when I play with McBrayer, it was really fun, and I love playing with McBrayer. And but totally different than when I play with McBrayer in Facebook, and when you even play with McBrayer in ASCAT.
Absolutely.
Because of Facebook, and you've been swung in and helped us numerous times when we're down, we've done a lot more two-person shows, three-person shows, and it's really interesting because the shows are changed so drastically. I did a two-person show with Charlie Sanders. And it was so different than my two-person show with Seth, which was a lot more patient and stuff like that. I love that thing of going like, well, let's do it. Maybe
and
it's
I've
a
also
scene,
been
maybe.
Trying to get people who don't, like I've done a bunch of them with Michaela Watkins, who did not come up in UCB and did not come, you know, up in Groundlings, so understands the fundamentals of improv, but it is not a part of
She's
her
like,
process exactly. And people like that, you know, I'm trying to get people to be like, you know, come and do this weird thing, because to do one scene for an hour is a very strange thing. And the kind of little, I always give people a little bit of the only bit of advice I give is at about 15 minutes. Like, there's going to be a natural edit.
Right.
There's going to be a natural, like, oh, well, that was this scene. We just fucking nailed it.
Yeah.
And you're going to then panic because you still have 45 minutes to go. And you're going to lose your mind and you're going to get really freaked out because you don't know what to do. And so my advice is always just emotionally go deeper.
That's interesting.
Because at a certain point, in order to sustain an hour, you can't have like a premise game-based 1 hour scene. You have to be on a journey with these two people emotionally that can have many different games, and oftentimes do, you know, within the course of that hour, we will have one narrative thread that has been completed. But then all these other side games patterns that are the kind of structural system that are holding that narrative up.
It's like it's in a weird way. I've only done it. I don't think I've ever done an hour. I think I've probably done like 45 minutes because Owen Burke, Chad Carter, and I used to do this thing called Bruckheimer. Mm-hmm. And Bruckheimer was a mono scene for like whenever it was, whatever the thought was, we would do it. And the lesson I always learned from that was enjoy slow. Like enjoy just not making big moments right away. Just like set the pace, set the thing, be quiet, exist in silences, play those moments. But
And that's also like I think that's such an important lesson to learn at any level, which is, and I think something also to go back to teaching that I used to say to classes all the time is, your job isn't to be hilarious on stage every second of every scene. You're not, when people walk on stage, you're not expected to never not be talking, one or the other of you, until someone edits you. Like, exist in silences. Let yourselves be interesting, even if you are not being funny. Like, that's, people will watch interesting, people will watch funny, people will watch emotional. People will, they're there to watch you exist on stage comfortably and confidently. They're not there to just be like have bits done at them for whatever, well, 3 minutes.
Yeah, I totally, totally agree. And this actually brings me into kind of what we're wrapping up here with is, so
wrapping up,
wrapping. I know. We're I feel like there's like, I keep on like jumping, cutting things. Yeah. I'm like, oh, I want to do. You know what we should do? We should like get like a small round table and do like a mini series of this. Like just like get like five people and like, and because it would all be interesting perspectives.
It would be interesting to do it generationally speaking.
Yes.
So take like get like from the Swarm to like the almost Pally generation, like go from Swarm to Hammercats, basically.
Yeah, I would even say, I think you go like Swarm to Ruru.
That's actually smarter. Yeah.
And then go from that to like Hammer.
That,
you know,
makes
like,
sense. That's actually two distinct,
just because we all kind of came generations up together. Yeah. It's like, who did you party with? Like, I mean, basically. Like, you know, it's like,
do you know what CL Rouge is? That's your entrance to.
What up, Jabroniacs? This is Dan Black from the Comedians of Wrestling podcast, the podcast where the world of comedy collides head-to-head with the world of professional wrestling. Past guests on the show have been WWE superstar Dolph Ziggler, WWE superstar John Morrison, WWE superstar Damian Sandow, plus hilarious comedians Lucas Brothers, Dante Germain. The list goes on and on and on. You can listen to the podcast every single Thursday. We are part of the UCB Podcast Network, jabronis.
Hey, improv fans. If the suggestion for your next show is beer, maybe initiate your scene with something like, check it out, they've got Bronx beer on tap at this bar. It's the start of a great scene, and ordering a Bronx is a great way to start any night out. And Bronx is now the official house beer of the UCB Comedy Podcast Network. Visit thebronxbrewery.com for more information, and be sure to make your next pint a Bronx. And scene.
So here is the kind of the end all thing, which is, we talk a lot about stage, but now talking about performing outside of stage,
sure,
and improvising outside of a stage. I've worked with you, you know, so many times now, you know, and I talked about this on my last podcast. Like, I feel like, tell me if you disagree or agree with me.
Sure.
This is my thesis. Like, I feel like improv and TV and film can go either two ways. Like, mm-hmm, there are people that are just like, let's improvise, and you just open it up. And it's people trying to make jokes. And mm-hmm, it's not people listening. And I think that has actually proven to be very successful. I don't like that. I always feel like I like improvising from a character point of view. And that means, like, I'm not making jokes. I'm being in the – I'm from
you
character.
You could very well much be improvising just, like, connective tissue. That's not funny.
Exactly. You know? But you're – and I find with you, improvising with you, you are – I feel like you're on that side of it. Like – I think what you do so well is you create a character, and then that world is, it can hold a lot of water, I guess. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Like, I can buy that one thing because of this other thing, and it's all specific. And I will just to draw the comparison of like Rafi, who is a very heightened character,
sure,
in this world that he came into in this show.
Yep.
You built something that existed and had like walls, if that makes sense. Like there were things that you would do and there are things that you wouldn't do. Mm-hmm. And I think that like, so how do you approach that? Like going into like improvising on, you know, screen, I guess, for all intents and purposes.
Sure. I think, you know, Rafi from the league is the easiest example just because it is the whole show was improvised.
Yeah.
You know, purposefully so. It wasn't like I came in to a heavily scripted show and was like, I want to improvise. Like the structure of how we built that show was improvised, was through long improvised takes. But I think like, you know, kind of what you're talking about, it would have been very easy to come in with that part, like the maniac kind of unhinged lunatic, and have had everything just be that, you know, and it would have been funny. But I think the reason that like Rafi ends up sticking around a long time, because the character is only supposed to be in, I think, 3 or 4 episodes or something.
And I will go back and just say to your credit, Rafi was pitched and we talked about Rafi as just being an annoying guy.
Yeah, totally.
Like there was no like my brother is an, it was like, oh, we don't want to get my brother-in-law in this league because he's at the Chipotle right now. He's waiting. Like it was like it was unknown, but you like that was you and that your was
that was the people that created the league. Jeff and Jackie Schaefer were very generous in the sense that they basically were like the plot of this storyline is Nick wants his brother-in-law in the league so that he can curry favor with his wife.
Right.
Everybody hates him.
Right.
And then he get, you know, he's in for an episode, then everybody hates him, so then they kick him out, and then that's it. And they were like, we went out to lunch, and they were like, what version of that would you want to do?
Yeah.
Like, how do you want to come at that? And I was like, I feel like you guys don't have, like, a charming maniac. And that's kind of, I can do that pretty well.
Yeah.
And so they were like, great. Let's do that, you know? And originally the character's name was Sheldon. I don't know if you remember that.
But I just remember Brolo El Cunado.
Yeah, like when they pitched it to me, initially it was somehow called Sheldon, and then it changed to Rafi and all that stuff. Anyway, but like I think the part of the success of it was like really trying to find things. Like I think one of the things that was transformational in that character was because it wasn't just improvising horrible things to say. Because I also started improvising that Rafi loved the guys.
Yeah.
That part of this storyline started to become the storyline of a very lonely man who does not have friends and is suddenly given friends.
Yeah.
And his not being able to recognize that these people hate him allowed him to continuously assert that these were his friends and made people weirdly like him.
Well, you also, not being the maniac all the time, you were always maniac, but it was like, but you would take things in.
Oh, yeah.
Like, and
there were emotional stakes to it for him.
And
didn't add up to the guys oftentimes.
No. And and that's an interesting thing because, again, going back to this theory that I was like kind of railing on the last episode, is like, I don't like just jokes for jokes' sake because it's sort of like, to what end? It's like then it just feels like a bunch of improvisers doing something that's being taped.
100%. And at a certain point, I'll watch that. I think that that is the purview of sketch comedy. I think that is like where like joke machine characters kind of thrive.
Yeah.
Or on like shows like Children's Hospital or what you guys were doing on NTSF. Like in a shorter show that you can really just dig in on jokes and heightening.
Yes.
Because the next episode you're kind of resetting the board.
Right, yeah.
But something that is kind of continuing a narrative, I believe this whether I'm improvising on stage, whether I'm improvising on screen or you know, whatever, if it can't come from some emotional point of view for me, like if I can't figure out, and this is why, and you know, we've talked about this many times, but I would get into fights with the people who did the league because they would pitch stuff that I was like, Rafi wouldn't do this,
but
it's so stupid. But like one of them was like, they really wanted him to be inexplicably doing like hot yoga, and I was like, but why? It was a whole thing, but it really was like, no, I think like there needs to be like like rules for how this guy works.
Yes.
And if we can keep operating within the rules of that, I think the audience is never going to be bumped out of it.
Like, right, because you don't betray the character to get a joke.
Like, why is, like, on Game of Thrones right now, why is Bran acting so weird just because he's the three-eyed raven? It's making it harder for me to get on board with that character.
Right, right.
Because he's behaving inconsistently from what I've known him to be in the past. And to me, this is so, like, pretentious, but it's the same with a comedy character. You can, just because you can think of a funny joke doesn't mean that character would do that joke.
Right.
It just means you thought of a funny joke.
Because that's you, the improviser, not you, the character.
Correct.
And I think that those are my issues with the league, too. Like, they would pitch me sometimes things that I was like, well, for me to say this, I'm insane.
Yeah.
And I need to now figure out how I'm not insane.
Totally.
Or I have to, like...
Allow it to just, hopefully... wash on by.
But those are the fights that, there was, and this is the joke, we talk about this in the past, mm-hmm. It was the idea that, in a scene, someone said something about me being bald, and I was like, well, I'm not bald, and I said, I'm thinning, of course, but I have a clear, it's very thin, very clear hair, and they jumped on clear hair.
Sure.
And there was a whole episode written about how I have clear hair and I'm combing my clear hair and I'm doing all this stuff. And I'm like, that's insane.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not going to be in a brush in a mirror. Now I can see somebody who's like afraid of like losing their hair and like you have like those little specks or whatever.
Totally.
Like, and that's where I was coming from and saying it.
Which is appropriate.
Right. And just saying it's not
like
dark
because
it used
a,
to be. Yeah. But it's lighter. It's like... It came from an organic. It wasn't.
One is delusional, and one is perhaps like insecure.
Yes.
Poor word choice.
And kind of justifying it. Like, I'm not losing. It's thinner and it's lighter and it's
totally. It makes total sense.
It's funny, but that's the thing. It's like and you have to fight for those moments in a character because.
And I will say, I really. I don't mind fighting for those moments. I enjoyed it because, they gave us something. Now, having worked on many other things, as I'm sure you have, too, we had on that show a degree of control and power over our characters that
we had ownership.
Very rare. We
had ownership of our characters in the way that we could create a direction for them, not necessarily plot-wise, but emotional life-wise.
And how they talked.
Oh, yeah.
And how they, just in terms of, stuff that, to me, is important, word choice, stuff like that was ours to build. And that was a real, a huge, for that to have been, a lot of our first big job.
Yeah.
Was huge for me just to be able to have that much kind of control over that character.
Well, and I'll also say that in the power of the edit, they were very competently cutting together a show that, it wasn't always the first take. It wasn't like everything was great. They were crafting things around the two. Because I think improv is
out of
a great tool, but you need solid.
Hours of footage. I mean, we shot for that show, I'm going to say... 10 times more,
easily.
Minutes of these scenes than if you were to have scripted them, blocked them, and shot them.
You literally, when I was watching the show, I never knew what was going to be on it.
Totally.
Because
we would do so much.
So much. And stuff that I loved would never get on it. And stuff,
I'm always hopeful because this was also before this is before people would dump stuff online. Here's
4 minutes
that we couldn't fit into the episode, but here it is cut together. I still wish we would have had more of those because that show, there are still things that we did on that show that were so funny, but never couldn't make it in, usually for time.
Yeah, it's, we just cracked the surface, but.
I could talk about this for hours.
I love doing this, and I would love to do more of this. So here we go. This is it. That was a long-form conversation. Next week's episode, we'll pick up with a new round of improvisers based in New York.
Holy cow.
But fear not, because someone will be your host. And I have the ultimate faith in the UCB Podcast Network that they will provide you a great host. I am Paul Scheer. This is Jason Mantzoukas.
Thank you so much.
And bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the UCB Longform Conversations podcast on the UCB Comedy Podcast Network. If you like this podcast, please subscribe and review at itunes.com/UCB Comedy. The opinions expressed in this episode are those of the comedians talking and don't necessarily reflect the opinions of UCB Theater or Training Center. Find cutting-edge comedy videos on YouTube and Vimeo at UCB Comedy. Find our live shows at UCBtheater.com and connect with us on social media at UCB Comedy.
Thanks to the Bronx Brewery, the official house beer of the UCB Comedy Podcast Network, for their support. Visit thebronxbrewery.com for more information on all their craft beer. And be sure to make your next pint a Bronx.